Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of The Rounds. And I am your host, Chris Algieri. Today, we'll be speaking about fighting on the road, dealing with the unknown, getting out of your comfort zone, and battling on foreign territory. Two veterans of this and two of the best who've ever done it, we have dazzling Darren Barker and Carl the Cobra Frotch, two men who are very familiar with fighting on the road. Hey, Carl, so how have you making out in all this?
Yeah, all good, Chris. Nice to see you, mate.
Good to see you too, man.
How are you? Yeah, I'm all right, mate. I'm good. I've got my kiddies, and it's tough homeschooling because they don't want to learn at home. They want to go outside and play, and obviously they don't want to be taught by the parents, and we're not qualified teachers. So I'm like, why can't he work out what 4 times 9 is when he knows the times table? So I don't know. It's made me realize how little school do for him. Actually, school actually is just, for me, as far as I'm concerned, it's just like daycare and indoctrination. That's all school is. But you know, he's getting through the work. I've got 2 daughters as well, a 7-year-old now. She turned 7 at the beginning of May, and a 4-year-old. So we've all 3 of them in the house. The 4-year-old's not at school. She's just like at nursery. So she's causing chaos at home now. She's not at nursery. She needs full attention. And then the 9-year-old and the 7-year-old, boy and girl, they're at school, but different classes. So it's just hard work, mate. It's fucking aggro. We've been looking forward to another break, which is this. I think there's a week May bank holiday, which we're in. Mm-hmm. But other than that, I'm just in my, I've got a big garden at the back of my house. I've been doing building works. I've still got a big plot going up in Mapley Park, which is quite an affluent area in Nottingham, building a really nice place there. And I've also got 15 apartments now just been approved for planning, so that I'll make a start on that soon. The building game's kind of back up and running. The construction, the building merchants are open, so we can get materials now. So we're going to start digging footings and laying down bits and bobs and make a start on the building work. So I'm busy enough.
Darren, I hope you're taking notes over there. You were saying that you were a little bored in all this. This guy is staying quite busy.
Yeah, you got any jobs, Carl?
It's boring. I need some. Got a few trenches need digging. You're good on the shovel, aren't you?
Seen them guns.
Yeah, okay. Still got it. Well, yeah, today we're going to talk a little bit about, battling on the road, going on the road and having big fights. Neither of you are a stranger to having big fights while traveling. Carl, most of your big fights before the last few have been abroad or on the road. So definitely no stranger. Darren, yourself, two of your biggest fights were stateside at Atlantic City. So maybe if Darren, you could start us off, just kind of talk to us about that process, getting your big shot and finding out that it's going to be somewhere you've never been, something foreign, and what it's like in terms of preparing for that, not only mentally, but also physically, training in a new place, training in a new state, how early do you get there? How does it work with the rest of your team? Just kind of give a little insight into that whole process.
Well, do you know, for me, and I think Carl will be the same, well, I know Carl will be the same, when we box for England as amateurs, you do an awful lot of traveling then. So going out to the States, fast forward whatever many years, 10 years, 5 years, whatever it was, it wasn't alien to me. I was used to traveling, going to some real hostile countries and having to perform. And it, in some respects, I would say the amateur game was harder because you could, if you win a gold medal, you get to the final, you're probably having 4 or 5 fights. So you've got 4 or 5 different opponents, extremely good fighters. So I think that those experiences helped me a lot. I've done a lot of sparring abroad as well, which held me in good stead. And obviously being with Carl, I guess, in the same sort of promotional stable, watching him and watching others go out to the States and actually going, I went to LA. Carl was supposed to fight when Howard Eastman fought Bernard Hopkins. So I was there throughout the build up and that held me in good stead. But it was always a dream of mine to go to the States and fight. But to win a title over there was epic. I think both times, the Martinez and the Daniel Gill fight, I think we went out 2 weeks before. Mm-hmm. I also went to Canada to defend my Commonwealth title, and that was sort of edging towards the West Coast. So I think we left a little a little longer, almost 3 weeks. But it wasn't, like I say, I didn't feel under pressure. I wasn't more nervous being in the States or being abroad. And I think a big part of that is, like I say, that experience I had as an amateur.
Makes sense. Carl, and you, I see the picture of you behind you. I can tell that's the Jermaine Taylor fight, one of my favorite fights, an amazing, amazing performance. And that was a huge fight on the road as well. What was that experience specifically, you know, leading up to that fight? And that was kind of really a breakout fight for you to the American fans.
Yeah, it was good. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed being on the road. Like Darren Barker said there, when we boxed for England, we actually, we go into hostile environments and we fight top fighters back to back. So multi-nations tournaments, you fight Monday, Tuesday, you might have Wednesday off, then you fight Thursday. If you make it that deep into the tournament, you fight again. So when I defended my first world title, which was the WBC, I beat against John Pascal in Nottingham, in my hometown. My first defense to be on the road, that was a Foxwoods Resort Casino in Connecticut. I was nervous about it all. Not so much about traveling away and boxing abroad, but more about Jermaine Taylor, former undisputed middleweight champion. And I saw him get out of this stretched limousine at the press conference when I got to New York. And he just looked like the Don. He had a nice suit on. He looked really crisp and clean. And he looked really, he looked really like polished. And
he looked the part. He looked the part.
I thought, there's Jermaine Taylor look. He's got an umbrella as well because it's raining a little bit. He's got this smart umbrella. And I was just there with my one true Saxon hoodie or my Lonsdale hoodie on my T-shirt thinking, do I even belong here, to be honest? So it was quite a daunting thing for me. And I was always quite nervous and apprehensive as a fighter, as an amateur, and then as a professional, not as much. But still, I mean, everyone feels nerves, but I was always a bit unsure of myself. And that was my first world title defeat, so I'd just become a new champion with a vacant title. So I should have fought Joe Calzaghe, but I didn't. Darren Barker's mate. And I fought Pascal instead, won the title, but still didn't know if I felt I belonged at world level. So I went over to America to fight Jermaine Taylor. And I trained in Niagara-on-the-Lake, which is in Canada. Lovely, lovely resort.
Exactly where I went for the Martinez fight.
Amazing place. And I was still under Mick Hennessy at the time. So a guy called Adam Harris, a Canadian, who's a great bloke. I still keep in touch with him. He's Canadian. And I can remember being at the Niagara-on-the-Lake. I don't know what the resort was. I can't remember the name of the resort. But it was a fantastic place, like a big health spa. And then there was a gym. Don't know what the gym was, but it was a big gym, very, very adequate, more than adequate for what we needed. And John Pascal, the guy I beat for the world title, was my chief sparring partner for the last 2 weeks before we moved over to, because Connecticut's like North America, right?
Correct, yeah, it's Northeast.
Like on the coast, yeah, on the coast of Canada, Northeast, on the coast of Canada. So it wasn't far away. So we was in Niagara-on-the-Lake right up until a week before going over to Connecticut. And John Pascal and his big brother were both trying to beat me up in sparring. So I had some great sparring. And then obviously went over to Connecticut and had that week build up. That was actually my now wife, Rachel, who's my wife. We got married last year. It was her first ever boxing match with me, first fight she ever went to.
Wow.
And what an amazing fight to be involved with. Like when I got knocked down in round three, like when I spoke to her after, she was like, oh, is this supposed to happen? What's going on? Is that bad news or will he be okay? So she didn't have a clue. And looking back on that fight now, because it was like 10-year anniversary or that's 12-year anniversary,
Coming up this month, correct?
It was April. It was April. So looking back on that now, how naive I was and how sort of not inexperienced, but inexperienced at world level and just putting all my trust in Rob McCracken and my fitness and, you know, my own ability and my refusal to quit in that fight came through. I mean, I'm very stubborn as a person. I'm very, very competitive by nature, whether I'm playing table tennis or tennis with my brother or golf. I like to win, or whether I'm sparring, which Darren Barker knows. If when we spar, and Barker likes to spar, every professional boxer likes to spar and feel that they've came out of the spar a winner, or rather than they've just been beat up. Because when I used to spar with Howard Eastman, I used to get beat up early on. He used to hit me with the right hands, and I used to think, oh, bloody hell, they hurt. And he used to control me with a jab, and he was so experienced and in control of the spar early on when I first turned professional. I didn't think I was good enough to be a top pro. I just thought I'll probably win a British title and I'll be okay at that level. But you slowly but surely get better. I mean, me and Darren Barker used to spar. It was always competitive. And he always says he hated sparring me because I used to take liberties. I was bigger than him. I was super middleweight. He was middleweight. But I used to hate sparring Darren because Darren was so skillful. He was skillful with his jab. He could punch when he set his feet. He'd always answer back. And he got that determination, which you saw when he won the title, the IBF against Dominic Gill. You saw the grit and determination that he has. And
do you remember the spa before you fought Pascal?
I can remember every spa with you. Go on, which one?
Where was it? In County Mayo in Ireland.
County Mayo, Castle and Marvel, I just, in Ireland.
Like, Cole was firing on all cylinders, just absolutely flying. You know, it was 12 round fit, ready for his first world title fight. And I went over there, did some sparring, and we'd been doing 8-10 rounds. And one day, I think I woke up, we were slated to do, like, again, 8 or 10 rounds. I just weren't feeling it. I just didn't fancy it this morning. So after 3 rounds, the 3rd round, I just unloaded. I just didn't stop throwing punches for 3 minutes. I got back to the corner and I went to my trainer, Tony Sims. I've been tearing my hands out a little bit. Just call it a day. Cole got out the ring and went, "You Judas me. You Judas me."
I was fuming. Absolutely fuming. Before you got there, I was sparring with that Louis Garcia, who was top amateur from Cuba. And he was giving me a real difficult spar. Then when Darren Barker turned up, the spar wasn't much easier because Darren could last longer. Darren could do 6-8 rounds where Garcia would run out of steam after about 4 or 5 rounds and I'd start to back him up and start to catch him. But we had some really good spars in County Mayo. And I think I learned so much sparring Darren. I had to box a move, use my jab, counter punch, because you have to be sharp against Darren. At that particular morning, I can remember, because you jumped in, round 1 and 2 was good. Round 3, you just properly stuck it on me. So I was defending, backing up, getting hit with everything. And I thought to myself, bloody hell, he can't keep this pace up, surely. And I went back to the corner and obviously he didn't come out for round 4. Yeah, I can remember that, Darren, but I'll give you that one. That's fair enough.
Darren gave you I'll give you as good as I can for as long as I can. But Darren, let's talk a little bit about, Carl mentioned how it was like seeing Jermaine Taylor step out of that limousine in New York City and having that vision of like, wow, this guy's the goods. And then questioning yourself, do I belong here? That does remind me a little bit of the buildup of the Sergio Martinez fight. When you fought him, he was the baddest man at middleweight and someone that people just did not want to fight. I was at that Paul Williams fight when he knocked him out with one punch. Absolutely tremendous, tremendous fighter at the time. And like I said, a guy that was often avoided, and you were coming over first time fighting in the States, and that was your opponent. What was that like being around that media attention and leading up to that kind of fight?
Yeah, it was nerve wracking. It was. I remember flying to New York with Eddie Hearn. We was in and out. We literally spent one night there for the press conference. And you know, to an extent, I seem to remember the Americans almost laughing and sniggering at me. That I showed any confidence, you know, though I was unbeaten, I was European champion. I just hadn't fought anybody. I was confident in my own ability, but it was the unknown. I just didn't know if I could, though I'd sparred with Cole, you know, we'd done hundreds of rounds, like with Cole, an elite level fighter, but it's still sparring. And you can only gauge so much, but I knew I was capable of being in there with elite level fighters, but I just didn't quite understand where I was at the time. And, you know, I don't really have any regrets when I look back at my career. But I think I do have a slight regret when I think back at that fight, because I just think if I would have believed in myself a little more, I probably would have just been slightly more aggressive. Not, you know, I wouldn't have been stupid, but I just would have forced the action a bit more and potentially could have caused a huge upset. I'm not saying I could, you know, potentially would have still lost anyway, but I just kind of wish I would have given it a bit more. But the whole build up was just, I just felt like this is what I was doing boxing. This is why I chose to become a boxer. You know, I'm on top of, you know, this huge skyscraper in New York doing the press conference in blistering heat, just thinking this is what it's all about. This is, you know, I've made it. It was great. A funny story, actually. I remember walking to the press conference with Eddie Hearn, and we're walking, I don't know, Fifth Avenue or something like that, and we walked past the shop and there was a mannequin with these bright green trousers. And Eddie said to me, you should buy those trousers for a laugh and wear them at the press conference. And I went, no, you've got to be joking. I wouldn't be seen dead in them. Got to the press conference and Martinez was wearing the exact trousers. I'm telling you.
Not surprised.
it was funny. But yeah, it was just the whole build up, the whole, you know, like I said before, being with Carl on certain camps and fights he'd been on in the States, it was just, I was so eager to have a taste of it for myself. And it was, you know, it was like a dream come true.
And let's not take away from your performance in that fight. That was the first time that I had actually seen you fight, Darren, was the Sergio Martinez fight. And you fought a brilliant fight. Exactly the way that Carl was explaining your style in the gym and in sparring was what you gave to Sergio. You were all over him, keeping your hands on him, keeping busy, boxing well behind your jab, and just keeping him so off balance. I thought it was a really, really great performance.
Cheers.
You know, even the way it did turn out. So.
Going into that fight, the game plan was to be aggressive. Mm-hmm. But be smart. Don't throw too many shots early on. Watch out for his big shots. Because, like you say, that the Paul Williams fight, that during the whole camp, that was the only clip I kept seeing. Constantly seeing Paul Williams get knocked out. So it was a bit nerve-wracking. But another thing with me, I boxed at an amateur boxing club in the East End of London, Repton, and there must have been something in the water there because they just they churned out so many top quality southpaws. So I had lots of good southpaw sparring, and I just had a good knack with southpaws. I was never fazed or worried about fighting southpaws, so I knew I'd be able to compete with him. But anyway, it was a great experience and an experience that was massively valuable to me going on to the Gill fight. I think just it being the second time round, you know, it certainly wasn't alien to me then. Just, it, you know, it wasn't my first weigh-in. It wasn't my first press conference. You know, it wasn't the first time in the ring in the States. It was just, I felt like I belonged. And it was, all, you know, it was bittersweet as well, I guess, going back to Atlantic City and winning the title there.
Beautiful. Let's switch gears a little bit and talk about some of the unforeseen things that can happen on the road. And Carl, I want to kick this one to you and talk a little bit about the European ash cloud and the fight with Mikkel Kessler that was going to be in Finland, that a week before the fight, because of the ash cloud and the volcanic eruption that were going on, that you didn't expect the fight to happen at all. So what was that like in terms of the mental preparation of preparing for a fight, preparing for a world title fight, a massive fight, and then it potentially being off, but then back on?
Yeah, well, it was a bit of a disaster for me because I woke up Monday morning, and on Monday, that's when I do my last long run. I want to say long, only 3 miles on a Monday.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not sprinting, it's not hill sprints or anything. It's just a nice 3 mile run, but sharp. So I run it quite quick. I do it in under 20 minutes. I'd have to check my diaries.
Good time.
My fastest ever 3 miler. Is something like just under 19 minutes. So it was a fast 3 mile run on the Monday. And on the Monday, this particular fight, when I was supposed to fight Kessler, I spoke to Rob McCracken, my coach, and I said, the flights are still cancelled. Still no further forward with this ash cloud in terms of opening up the flights. So it looks like we're not going. He says, I know. He says, pain in the arse, can't believe it. I've done all the training. What we're going to do? He says, we'll see. We can still go out there Wednesday if we have to, but ideally. So I went and did my run, and I can remember I did it in like 22 minutes. I was like half-hearted running.
Wait, Carl, real quick. That Wednesday, the Wednesday of fight week, so 3 days before the fight.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
So on that Monday, I did the run, and then he said we could probably go Wednesday. And sure enough, on Wednesday, they sent, was it the Wednesday or the Thursday? But they sent a private jet, the Salans, Calais and Nissa Saland. I think they was always going to do that, but they waited until Wednesday. So I can remember on the Tuesday when I thought flights are definitely cancelled. You turn Sky News on and all the airlines are grounded. I'm definitely not going to Herning in Denmark, and the American broadcasters aren't going to be able to come over from the other side of the Atlantic either. So I thought the fight's definitely off. So we had a barbecue in my back garden. I had a couple of cans of Guinness. It was like, I mean, I don't drink much, but I'm drinking alcohol that week. I don't drink for 12 weeks. I don't drink much anyway. So a couple of cans of Guinness for me, I'm like, oh, I can tell I've had a drink. I'm up to about 12 stone 10, and I do the weight quite easy. But anyway, Wednesday, Mick Hennessy rings me, right, they're sending a plane to East Midlands Airport, which is half an hour from where I live. It's 2 o'clock flight. I'm like, for fuck's sake, really? We've got to go? Is it definitely on? So I was kind of jumping on this private jet, and it sounds glamorous, but there was nothing glamorous about this private jet, let me tell you. It was 4 seats or 5 seats. We sat on there, me, Rob McCracken, my wife, and Pat Sheehan from The Sun. And it was really low, this plane, just above the trees, and it was bumpy all the way. Rob McCracken hates heights. He won't mind me telling you. He's got a fear of heights. He was white all the way, didn't say a word. He was hanging on to the bloody side of the seat, looking at me. I'm looking at him. I'm winding him up, saying, I think we're banging trouble here, you know. There's planes all over the place. I think we're going down. Anyway, we got there. Then I jumped into like a rally sports car, which they had lined up for me, and got my adrenaline really up. It was like an Evolution 6 sports rally car, ran a track, did a few laps of the track while they filmed a few bits. So then we're off to the hotel. So I'm full of adrenaline. I've just flew in. I'm overweight. And I'm like, bloody hell, my feet are just on the ground now. Wednesday night going to bed, jumped on the scales, 12 stone 9. I told Rob since, but I told him that I was 12 stone 4, 12 5. And so what I did was I sat in a red hot bathtub and sweated for about 2 or 3 hours, kept filling the water up, keeping it hot, put a couple of towels over my head, and I'm sweating, and I've took some weight off. Then on the Thursday, didn't eat anything, took more weight off. So basically, I crashed the weight, which I never do. So come the weigh-in on the Friday, I just felt really tired and weak, and probably how Darren Barker and most professionals feel at the weigh-in. I never used to struggle at the weight, you see. Mm. That was the first time I've ever took weight off. And I don't want the listeners to think that this is an excuse, because on the night, I thought that I was fit enough and tough enough and strong enough, and had a great 12 rounds with Mikael Kessler, who was a top fighter. And on the night, I thought I got beat. I just didn't think I did enough, especially with it being in Denmark. But going over there underneath the ash cloud on the Wednesday fight week, and being overweight and in my head switching off and then having to switch back on, it was horrible. It wasn't ideal. And it ended with me losing on points against the top fighter. But I'm a big believer in things happen for a reason. You learn a lot in boxing. You don't win and lose. You win and learn. So if you lose, you learn something about yourself and you learn how to come back. And in my very next fight, I fought Arthur Abraham for the very same title, the WBC title, because I was in the Super 6 World Boxing Classic. So that kept my spirits high and kept me, you know, because I was really upset when I lost that fight, and I was really mentally dejected and like really down for a long time. And then when I realised that Mikael Kester's now retired because he's injured from the fight, he had a bad cut above his eye, mm-hmm. and his eye was a bit dodgy. I think his muscle was damaged. So the WBC title was back up for grabs, back in the tournament in my very next fight against Arthur Abraham. So that boosted my spirits and got me going again. So the loss didn't feel as bad as, say, when I lost to Andre Ward. That felt like a bad loss. I never got going. When Darren Barker said he never got going against Sergio Martinez, I think that's probably because he was a little bit unsure of himself. Probably going into that fight thinking, I'm fighting the top fighter here who can punch. Just knocked out Paul Williams in a bad knockout. And he's thinking to himself, it's all right being aggressive, but if I walk onto one of them. So you get in the ring before that bell goes and you're a bit unsure and you're a bit standoffish. And I was like that with Ward. I'm not saying the result would have been any different. Andre Ward's a fantastic fighter, very skillful, very fast, hard to hit. Impossible to land, and he's good with his jab as well. So I'm not saying it would have been any different, but I can remember getting out of the fight thinking I had a decent round 10, 11 and 12 and I was getting into it, and I thought, why didn't I start earlier? Why didn't I get on with it? Why didn't I believe in myself? Why didn't I throw more punches? But that's what we do when we lose. We try and look for reasons why we lost. And the volcanic ash cloud was no excuse for losing to Mikael Kessler, but it was one of my stories for fighting away from home that's a real bad preparation, a bad final prep for a massive fight, you know, to fly over there late, so late and overweight, and then jump in the ring with a tough guy like Mikael Kessler.
Yeah, that's one of the things about fighting the road and why fighters don't like to do it is because of the unknown. Situations like that can occur and kind of throw off everything you got going. Like you said, thinking about the fight, not thinking about the fight and having to turn back on is something that is so difficult for people to understand. You're dialed in for 12 weeks, and then right before, you have to shut it down. Very difficult thing to come back from. But that Abraham fight, absolutely tremendous performance. Abraham, at that time, was one of the most dangerous punchers in the world. A guy that you have to be dialed in on for 12 full rounds. Great, great performance there.
100%. And in that fight, I showed why I won 2 ABA titles and a medal in the World Championships. A lot of people look at myself and say, Carl Froch is just super fit and tough. And right. He's a warmonger. He stands in front of you, take a load of shots to land one. But actually, you don't win ABA titles and medals for England if you can't box a little bit, you mm-hmm. know. And in that fight against Abraham, I didn't want to get hit. I wasn't scared, but I was concerned about getting hit with his big power punch. I see him knock out Jermaine Taylor. They give him a brain bleed and injured him. And I thought to myself, bloody hell, he's got a massive knockout ratio. So the plan going into that fight was to just box and move and unload punches. When he stands there with a tight high guard, mm-hmm. you've basically got a license to throw six punches. Because he can't really hit you back. He's mm-hmm. not in a position to punch from there. So right. I just four to the head, two round the body. As he drops his gloves, two more back on the head. So 7-8 punch combinations in bursts throughout the rounds. And then I'd just get on my back foot and use my jab because he was too short for me. So mm-hmm. that was one of my best performances, but in many ways, one of my easiest performances, but not in any disrespect for Abraham. But the fact that I was so fit and conditioned for 12 rounds and I believed in myself and I was so determined after losing to Kessler, I think that was kind of one of my flawless victories where I can look back and say, you know what, that was probably one of the perfect performances that, as a fighter, I put on, even better than the Lucien Boutte one. Because the Boutte one, I took a lot of punches coming in. I was walking into his left cross mm-hmm. to get mine off. And that was a bit of a warmonger type of win. But the Abraham win was, by my standards, a boxing masterclass. Because Darren Barker used to outbox me all the time in sparring. And it's that kind of boxing lessons I used to get that gets me ready for fights like that, because you've got to be quick on your counter punch, you've got to be sharp on your jab, you've got to throw lots of feinting, and that's what the sparring does. So that's the Kester fight and the Abraham fight both wrapped up for you there.
Speaking of being in supreme condition and believing in yourself, Darren, your fight with David Gill when you did win the IBF world title, and you had to stay busy, be on top of him, and then to deal with the knockdown, which was a brutal body shot. And to come back from that shows not only supreme conditioning, but also tremendous heart. Maybe talk a little bit about that, the preparation for that fight, the mindset, how that was different mentally for you than the Sergio Martinez fight.
Yeah. Well, again, you know, it was Atlantic City. It wasn't alien to me. I'd been there, I'd done it. And I was driven to right that wrong. You know, I wanted to come away from the States, Atlantic City, with a world title. The game plan was quite similar. It was to be aggressive on the front foot, but be smart, hold the center of the ring and you know, work well behind the jab. But it wasn't till I got in there with Daniel Gill, I realized how awkward he was. He had a good knack of getting out of range, and I was falling short with some of my shots. So I quickly adopted a different game plan, which was just to get on his chest, to kind of nullify that the good footwork he had, get on him and just try and outwork him. I mean, I'd been suffering a lot with injuries. I had two hip operations. But for that fight, I'd done a lot of swimming. My preparation was brilliant. So I knew I could, so a lot of people didn't think I'd be able to outwork Daniel Gill, because that's what he's good at. But I knew I was fit enough to do it. And to be honest, that the moment I got knocked down with in the sixth round, a lot of people know that my brother passed away. He was a very good fighter, and I was just look, if I would have lost that fight, that would have been the end of my career. I never would have fought ever again, and there would have been a box that hadn't been ticked. You know, I achieved everything else, but there would have been one thing missing, and it would have eaten away at me, I think, later on in life. So I was just so prepared to give it everything and leave everything in the ring that night that, you know, a body shot was never going to keep me down. And fast forward to the 12th round and hearing Michael Buffer say, and you know, and the new just is just, you know, I still can't believe it. Like, I still can't believe, you know, though Cole and these other legends of the sport achieved a lot more than I did, numerous weight world titles, numerous world titles, I still achieved what I set out to do. You know, I become a world champion. And when we go to different functions, there's two shows that you go to in England. There's the Boxing Rioters dinner. That's on a Monday night, and there's the British Boxing Board of Control Awards that is in a big hotel, and everyone's announced in the room. You get you know, all the great fighters in attendance, and at the end of that presentation, they announce the world champions in the room, and I still can't believe that I'm in that group of fighter. You know, I'm just, you know, like again, I can't express what it means to me that I can say I was a world champion. You know, it just crazy. Like I said, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying I'm in Joe Cal's Aggie Cole Frotch's or that, you know, their sort of ilk. But still,
yeah. But if you never won that world title, though, you could never say you was a world champion. So I totally understand what that means to you to be the IBF.
Oh, incredible!
Such an emphatic fight as well. It wasn't a gimme, was it? It was a dramatic fight. You got put down, and everyone thought you don't quite belong at this level. When you go down, people will look and say, "Oh, there you go. Look, Barker don't really belong here. He's down." But to climb off the floor and win in the manner in which you did in a close fight that you deserved to win. There was no disputing the decision. You won the fight, but if it had gone either way, you might have gone, well, he was unlucky there. But to win that the way you won it, mate, you should be very proud of that. And don't say that you don't belong in certain people's levels, because you had a fantastic career.
You know, for me,
you became a world champion.
Yeah, for me, you know, I think there was a lot of question marks over my toughness, but you know, you'd know Carl and Tony and Rob McCracken knew that I was tough. You know, you can't be doing 12 rounds with Carl Frotch unless you're tough. You can't. So I always knew that there was a fight out there for me to show to everyone that I was mentally and physically tough. And you know,
and you beat a champion. You didn't. You beat the guy who was defending his belt. It wasn't a vacant title. It wasn't a fight that was set up for you. You know, it was a difficult opposition for sure. And David Gill was a very good fighter.
That's a really valid point, because there are champions out there that haven't actually taken a title off a champion or beat a champion for that belt, which is hard to do.
Very hard.
There's fighters out there that have become world champion, not actually beating a champion, and it means a lot to do it the way you did it.
Cheers.
Agreed. Carl, let's talk about the fights over in England. You came back to fighting at home, the Lucien Boutte fight, which was, again, at the time, Lucien Boutte, I remember watching him and here stateside and being like, wow, this guy is a monster. Southpaw, knocking everybody out, knocking guys out with body shots, with headshots. Absolutely dangerous guy. You set up, you get that fight. He comes to you. It is a resurgence of British boxing there for you to do that. Open up the floodgates for what later comes in the fights with Groves. Speak a little bit about, you know, that fight and what that meant for the rest of your career.
Well, we spoke about this yesterday on my plug alert, Frotch on Fighting podcast with Eddie Hearn yesterday, and it was a big turning point for British boxing, for Eddie Hearn at Matchroom, because he had Cale Brook, he also had Darren Barker, but it was quite wet behind the ears in terms of promoting, and he was new to the sport. I think he was only 30 years old or 31 years old, Eddie Hearn, when I had that meeting with him at the Institute of Sport in Sheffield, when I was moving promoters from my old promoter, I don't even ever mention his name anymore, and I moved over to Eddie Hearn, and I was thinking, I need to get back on Sky. And I'm not getting any television coverage in Britain. Rob McCracken said that Eddie Hearn's honest as the day is long. You can trust him. You can trust his dad, Barry Hearn. So I had a meeting with him. And although I did the Johnson fight, which was a tough one and quite close, actually, Glencoff Johnson, and then I lost to Andre Ward, and they were shown on Sky Sports, there wasn't really big fights in terms of people didn't really see much of me. They didn't really see me fighting at my best. It was a bit of a lazy performance against Johnson, just a workmanlike performance. And then I obviously lost to Ward. So it was like, that's my resurgence back on Sky. And no one, but it was in America and it was early hours of the morning, so not many people would have seen it. Mm-hmm. But this fight with Lucien Boutte was me coming back after a loss, fighting for an IBF world title against an unbeaten guy who's beating everyone, knocking him out. And it was a toss-off between who's the best super middleweight in the world. Is it Andre Ward or is it Lucien Boutte? Ward's just won the Super Six. Boutte's unbeaten IBF champ. So really, that's the fight that should have happened. And it should have been for the Ring magazine belt as well. But they thought they could come to England, come to Nottingham, because he was getting criticised for never being on the road much. He was always fighting in Canada. So they thought, you know what, we'll go over to England and we'll beat Frotch. We'll have easy pickings with Carl Frotch. He's just lost to Ward. He's getting old. He's got some silver hair coming through. I think he's finished. So they took a calculated risk. And Eddie Hearn got them over to England, which was significant for me because he boxed me in my hometown in Nottingham. I've never lost in Nottingham. I've got all my schoolmates there, my best friends, all my family. And when I walk into the arena, I feel like I'm unbeatable, no matter who I'm in there. Whether or not I am unbeatable, who knows? But in my head, I cannot be beaten Nottingham. So the Lucien Bute fight for me, coming back after the Super Six and losing to Ward, was a massive fight for everybody. Massive fight for me, massive fight for Eddie Hearn, massive fight for British Boxing and Sky Sports. And yeah, the pressure was on. I wasn't 100% sure I could beat Bute, but when I watch his fight clips back and I watch him beat Brian McGee to a body shot, and I watch him outbox a few people with his slick southpaw skills, there was nothing that I saw in there where I thought I could be in trouble here. I didn't think he was a massive puncher. I didn't rate his boxing ability. I thought he looked a little bit, he looked a little bit like Mr. Bean, if you like. I don't want to be disrespectful or horrible, but when I look at him and when I met him and I shook his hand, I just thought, I can't lose to this geezer. He looks like a geek. He looks like a bit of a geek. Like, he's not a tough guy. He's got nothing about him, where I thought.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Rob McCracken saying to me, look, he's coming into your hometown, coming into your city, and he thinks that he's going to come and beat you up in front of everybody. Just run him out of town. Just put it on him and run him out of town. Get him out of there. He called him a cheeky, and he swore, and he said, get him out of there. And I was really nervous. The ring walk coming out to No Easy Way Out, the Rocky theme tune, and getting pumped up on the ring walk and stepping through the ropes. I was just absolutely fired up. Still upset about the Andre Ward loss. I got beat fair and square. I'm not saying that because of that, because I lost. I lost fair and square, but I lost. And I wanted to prove to myself that I could become world champion, that I wanted to be back in Britain, fighting on UK soil. And, you know, I was offered the same money, which wasn't big money, by the way, either, for a world champion that's just done what I've done in the Super Six, because I earned decent money in the Super Six. It was seven figures every time I boxed in the Super Six. It was six figures for the Bute fight, and only just as well. So I took a massive pay cut, and I could have fought a mark time fight. I could have fought a journeyman, or just somebody just to get me back on British soil, get me back on Sky. And Eddie said, look, you're only going to earn the same money if you fight Joe Bloggs, or if you fight Lucien Bute. Let's have a warm-up fight. Let's get you back in Britain. I was like, no, I just lost the Ward. I need a title. I need a world title to motivate me. Otherwise, I've kind of had enough. I don't even want to box anymore. I've got my kids. I've got two young kids. I'm in a position now where I'm thinking I'm financially in a good position as well. Do I need this fight? So I said to Eddie, look, let's get the world title. And I thought, if I get beat, if I go out, I've gone out on the top and there's no easy way out. Hence the ring tune. No Easy Way Out, the Rocky anthem, and everything just felt right. And that fight for me was one of my most significant wins, one of my most brutal wins, and one of my best performances in terms of who it was against. You know, I took Lucien Bute zero. I beat an unbeaten fighter for another world title. And the manner in which I did it, it was really explosive and really aggressive and quite brutal. And you would not have wanted to be on the receiving end of that pasting for any amount of money. And Bute, to be fair to him, he stood there, he took his licks, he never went over. He kind of went over as the ref was stopping it against the ropes. But what a tough guy. And that win for me set me back up and charged me again for the rest of my career, which was obviously Kessler rematch, Groves 1, Groves 2 at Wembley.
Yeah.
I missed out Yusuf Matt there, because that was the first mark time fight that I had in years.
Mm-hmm.
Young Yusuf Matt, who was actually not a bad light heavyweight.
No.
He just went the distance with Tavoris Cloud in a half-decent fight. And I thought, you know, he might present a few problems, but I went in there and just folded him in half with a body shot in round three, I think it was.
They say fortune favors the bold. Carl, you're definitely a bold man. Taking that Bute fight after in the position that you're at, I know for me, watching you during that time, that really opened my eyes. Like, wow, this guy is really special. And
I was in my early 30s as well. I was early 30s and I'd just done the Super Six. You know, mm-hmm. I was thinking to myself, do I want to fight a 12-week, go in a 12-week camp and fight a nobody that proves nothing? And then the Bute fight might not be there then. And then I might have to fight Ward again. And you know, for me to beat Ward, it's very, very difficult for me to beat Andre Ward. I think I would have had more chance of beating Andre Ward in Nottingham, because I'd have been so charged up. The performance that fought Bute would have had a better chance of beating Ward in my head. But in reality, I might have just got outboxed easier and I might have walked onto more, because I was a bit careless with my attacks. I was a bit crude with my aggression. And Andre Ward's a quality fighter. So,
yeah.
Again, you've got to take these opportunities. I took the Kessler fight when I flew under the S cloud. Then I come back after losing to Ward. I took the Bute fight and I was getting older and older. And by the time I'd finished the Yusuf Mack Kessler 2 rematch, with Kessler rematch, Groves 1, Groves 2, I was getting on for 37 years old. I mean, he had four more fights. All right, I've earned a right few quid because I'm on Sky pay-per-view. But if I never took the Butte fight, it could have been game over for me. I might have had one more fight, struggled. I might have fought James DeGale. There's a possibility of somebody like me losing to James DeGale on points. Very slim possibility. I reckon I'd have backed him up and smashed him to bits. But, you know, if I'd have lost to someone like James DeGale at the end of my career, that would have been an absolute wounder for me. But I took my opportunities, got myself fit and strong for every single opportunity that was put in front of me. And I feel I was justly rewarded in the end of my career because I got the accolade, didn't I? The Wembley Stadium thing and the Kessler fight as well, the Kessler rematch at the O2. For me, that was amazing. That was Sky pay-per-view, 20,000 at the O2, Kessler rematch. So I avenged the defeat. And I could have retired on the back of that and been probably really, really happy and satisfied. But we got the Groves saga, didn't we, at the end of my career, which was
real
icing on the cake.
Yeah. Speaking of the R word, retirement, I think I have a good idea of who's going to say what. But what are your thoughts, Darren, on the retired life? Do you ever think about what could have been, or ever coming back, or anything like that? Do you miss it?
No. I'm so content. I'm still around the fight game. You know, I do work with Matrim at all the shows. Don't get me wrong, I'll always, forever, like Carl and most professional sportsmen and women, we're extremely competitive. So, you know, nothing filled that competitive nature like boxing. Nothing's come close. So I'll always miss my arm being raised, but I'm just content. I think that's probably the worst thing you can be as a boxer, is content. Because if I compare myself now to the me who fought Daniel Gill, they're just two completely different people. If I see clips of that fight, I can't believe it's me. You know, I'm just soft now. You know, there is nothing hard about me or tough about me anymore.
That's what happens, doesn't it? You become civilized, and you do. You become like,
yeah.
I don't know about you, but I'll cry at certain movies, and I think, why am I crying?
I've watched Armageddon 12 times. I've cried 12 times. Armageddon.
I think that's just having kids as well. When you've got kids and that, you soften up. But I know exactly what you mean. I think with you as well, Darren. When you're injured, when you get bad injuries, like your hip injury. When it's so painful and so debilitating, like you can't go running. Because me and Darren was running in Castlebar County Mayo for my first defence. Actually, was that my first defence? No, that was my first.
No, it was your first world title,
Pascal.
Yeah.
That was Pascal. So I was there. And I can remember you and John O'Donnell like leaving me on the runs. But because you was leaving me on the runs, like you'd be like, 500 metres ahead of me. Mm. And you'd be slowly getting further and further away. I'd be trying so hard to catch them for this 40-minute run. I'd absolutely blow a gasket. I was blowing out of all quarters. Like my lungs were on fire, but that got me so fit and so ready for my world title fight. But later on in my career, say like after the Groves fight, when I was thinking about fighting again, I was thinking about fighting Chavez Jr. My Achilles tendon on my right foot, my lower back's always popping out of place.
Yeah.
My elbows when I'm missing with shots in the gym. You know, the aches and pains and the niggles as you get into your 30s. You get to a point where you're covered in duct tape, you're strapped up, you've got deep heat on your hands, your lower back sore, you're having cortisone injections everywhere. I had 5 operations when I was fighting. One on my nose, one on my knee, 2 on my hands, 3 on my hands. And it just gets to the point where you just think, I'm not enjoying this anymore. I can't be arsed to fucking warm up for 25 minutes to go on a 25-minute run. It's like an old cart horse. So when you look back and say, am I glad I retired or do I miss it? Yeah, you miss it. You miss the accolade. You miss the buzz of fighting, the natural euphoria and the natural endorphins that release before and after the fight and how great you feel for 2-3 weeks after the win. You're realistic and you know yourself, actually. If I go back in the gym, I've got to get up in the morning and do a morning run. Mm-hmm. Then I've got to go and spar Darren Barker. Or I've got to go and spar, you know, he's thinking I've got to go and spar Carl Froch. I could not think of anything worse than jumping in sparring with Tony Bellew. Tony Bellew tries to knock my head off when he's sparring me. And I don't mind because I'm trying to knock his fucking head off as well. It's just how it is.
Yeah.
But I could not imagine wrapping my hands up with a bandage, putting the tape on, looking over the gym, thinking, Tony Bellew, looking at me. And I'm thinking to myself, we're probably going to have 10 rounds today if I don't get chinned. You know what I mean? And it's just a horrible thought. It's horrible, really, when you look back on it and you think about what you did. But at the time, you enjoy it. We're different people. I think that's what I'm trying to say. Once you retire, you become a different person. And I think that's why it's dangerous, people thinking about coming out of retirement. You've got Tyson now and about fighting Holyfield, and they feel like they're relighting this old flame. But I think they'll soon realise, if they don't realise already, that once they start letting punches go in fight conditions, you absolutely just blow a gasket in about a minute. Because I have little play fights with my son and my older brother, and I hit the bag now and again. And how we used to do 12 3-minute rounds with them little 10-ounce gloves as well, because them gloves are small and they hurt. Mm-hmm. It's madness. It's madness. And I talk about coming out of retirement, and I have a little bit of a go at Joe Calzaghe now and again. And to be honest, a lot of it's tongue-in-cheek. He never fought me. He went on and beat Roy Jones and Hopkins. And the Hopkins win was a fantastic win as well, by the way, because what Hopkins did after Joe Calzaghe beat him. But because he didn't fight me, because he vacated the belt rather than fight me, I can always say, yeah, he vacated it, and give him a bit of shit. But I'm always, it's a bit of a joke. I'm messing around. I have a bit of a laugh of it. He had a fantastic career. But if he turned around and said, come on then, let's have a fight, I'd be thinking, oh, for fuck's sake. I don't want any of this. And I'd probably say, no, you know what? Let's leave it. I was only joking. Because the reality is, we're not going to be coming out of retirement after we've had the careers we've had. And when we look back on our careers, and Darren probably say the same, we had great careers, we reached great heights, we probably overachieved, or I certainly overachieved, to what I thought I could do. I think my toughness and my fitness got me a lot of wins. Where Darren, he's got the skill and the ability, and he talked about his toughness earlier. I can't say Darren's not tough, but I think I was exceptionally tough. I could really take a punch, and I really wouldn't quit. You know, when I was on my back foot and down and bruised and battered, I would get up and try and walk through walls. Like when I was behind against Jermaine Taylor. And, you know, certain fights, I just think to myself, I just keep going and keep going. And I think I've got the best out of my career. And there was nothing more for me to give, really.
It's very refreshing to speak to you two champions who are retired and happily retired, and also are happy with your careers, because I think a lot of guys can't look back and feel that same way. They feel like they missed opportunities, didn't take certain chances that they should have. You both seem like guys who took all the chances that were necessary to reach your absolute potential, and I applaud you guys. Thank you so much for the brilliant stuff.
No problem. I just want to know, pleasure, you're dead right what you said. I just want to give Eddie Hearn a bit of credit here, because, you know, Eddie Hearn turned around Darren's career or given the opportunities, and he did for me as well. I mean, I was having a great career. I was already world champion when I met Eddie Hearn. But the opportunities he gave me since I met him, and then getting me back on Sky Sports, and then we got back on Sky Pay-Per-View, and, you know, what he did as a promoter to say that, I know he had his dad helping him out and he could ask his dad advice, but Eddie Hearn is very innovative and very forward-thinking, and he's got a great mind and a great promotional skill. I don't know what it is, but he's a very talented man, and it doesn't pain me to say it because I like Eddie Hearn. But I just want to give him massive credit, because I think Darren will agree with me.
Yeah,
we never met the man that is Eddie Hearn. We would have never had the finish to our careers that we had. Darren would have never had the IBF title, and I would have never had, and I'm going to say it. I would have never had 80,000 fans at Wembley Stadium. It would not have happened. You've got to give him the credit for that. I've got that in now anyway.
Well, you got it in, 80,000 at Wembley Arena. One of the reasons of the rebirth of the stadium fights in England is the man right here, Carl Froch. Awesome stuff. Thank you guys so much. Carl, what is the name of your podcast that you just started?
Froch on Fighting.
Froch on Fighting, guys, check that out. I'm sure it's gonna be extremely interesting. Guys, thank you so much, Darren. We appreciate it taking the
Thanks,
time.
Chris. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you guys so much. Take care, gentlemen.
To that room.
Take care.